coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Everybody, and welcome to episode 44 of Curious Realm. Chris Jordan here, coming at you live tonight. Sorry about the pre-recorded episode last week, folks. On occasion, I am out of town for work, doing corporate events, or out visiting clients, or out actively recording stuff on location at festivals. This last week, I was actively preparing to... I had just had oral surgery on Monday, so did the pre-record because I knew my mouth would be like Phantom of the Opera swollen for 3 days, which it was. And then Saturday, I moved, so welcome to the whole new studio. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for right there is my applause. Yes, the whole new studio, everybody. Welcome. We have the Knowledge Vault here behind us, full of all the guest books, hundreds and hundreds of books. With that is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. That is our first guest this evening. Daniel J. Duke will be joining us after the top of the show, Tidbits, to talk about how he came to find out that he was a long-lost relative of the famous outlaw, Jesse James. And not only that, but Jesse James did not die, according to his research, the way that history tells us that he did. In addition to that, he may have had connections with people that knew where the Templar treasure was. So we will be getting into those topics in the first segment. Then after our commercial break, we will be coming back for our second segment, which is always our pre-recorded guest. We do that so that you get a little bit of different stuff. Not everybody is available to make it on a Tuesday night, especially as it goes late for the East Coast. In addition to that, it's hard for me to technically make the juggle in between things and make sure that everything gets pulled off properly. As I like to tell people all the time in the live event world, yes, we can pull rabbits out of hats all day, but eventually either the rabbit or the hat will not work. And hopefully it's the hat when you're in front of the children. So, with all the technical issues, we have gone to pre-recorded guests in the second segment. Our second segment will be the great and amazing Dr. Robert Duncan tonight, talking about the recent revelations in the world of Havana Syndrome, the CIA doctor that has actively come down with symptoms of the syndrome that he was researching. He is now officially the first civilian casualty. Until this point, everybody with official Havana syndrome, as it is now known, has been U.S. ambassadors. There was some scuttlebutt originally about maybe some of their kids or relatives who'd come to visit them had experienced things, but not into the realm of soft tissue brain damage, like the actual sufferers of Havana syndrome have experienced. And of course, as TIs across the globe, targeted individuals, folks, TIs, people who say that they are targeted by mass stalking means, digital electronics, satellite weaponry, microwave weaponry, which we now know actively exists for years, much like hypersonic technology. The government was like, oh, no, we don't play with things like that. We don't. Nope. Sorry, we have them. They're there. They actively exist. And now, because of things like Havana syndrome, they have to actively admit that they exist. So, interesting little tidbit there. We will be getting into a lot of targeting technologies, including technologies of being able to program dreams, communicate with dreamers. What is the next subliminal image that you'll see? Is it actively on a TV commercial or embedded in a podcast you're listening to? By Curious Realm. or, you know, is it in your dreams? So we'll be talking about that with the amazing Robert Duncan, author of How to Tame a Demon in the second part. Right now, let's head on over to the Facebook group and check out our news of the week. News of the week is, of course, always brought to you by the Facebook group, Curious Realm. Stop on by, join the conversation. Over 1,000 members there. We post articles. We have conversations about them. It's fantastic. Out of DailyStar.UK, quote, virtual children to replace real kids by 2015, and quote, help with overpopulation. Out of finance.yahoo.com, want fries with that? Robot makes French fries faster and better than human beings do. That one's pretty wild to go and watch that video. Out of space.com, super Earths are far more common and more habitable than Earth. Astronomers are finding more of the billions of them out there. There's an actual picture of the studio. That is the knowledge vault as it was completed the other day. Out of collider.com, actor Bruce Willis becomes the first celebrity to sell his rights to deepfake firm. Now, granted, he has come out and said, I didn't do that. I don't know what you're talking about. But here recently, the great and amazing James Earl Jones sold the rights to his voice as Darth Vader to an AI firm and to Disney. So until the end of time and Star Wars as we know it, James Earl Jones will always be the voice of Darth Vader, whether he is alive on Earth or not. That's some pretty wild stuff when you think about it, you know, and we said for a long time, probably even back when we were dudes and beer, that's over 5 years ago now, the Adobe software that if you had 20 minutes uninterrupted of somebody speaking, you would be able to type anything on a keyboard and it would just say in their voice. It was going to be deepfakes. B, it would change contracts in Hollywood as we know it. Because at that point, I get guaranteed every single actor out there has gone and done ADR. You know, like after edit restorations, where you go in and you overdub your own lines over the scene because there's street level noises going on, things like that. So all the major actors have at least 20 minutes of their voice recorded. And at that point, you could literally go out and go, you know what? I want James Cagney to appear in my movie for 20 minutes. And you write his script and you put it through the software, and James Cagney is now a voice actor in your movie. It's pretty wild technology. It's out there, and it has become incredibly easy to find. Go out and watch the videos of the Adobe premieres that came out. Not Adobe Premiere, but the premieres of this software about 5 years ago. Wild stuff. So that is the news of the week, folks, brought to you by Facebook. While you are online on Facebook, make sure, of course, to stop on by the Curious Realm website. Curious Realm is where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can tune in live. Little bit of an issue with my live connection this evening, so no live stream to the website tonight. However, make sure to stop on by and get our free app for Android. Make sure to stop on by and check out our events list. Coming up soon, we will be out at Texas Bigfoot Conference. That's going to be super fun. Cannot wait for that. We should have Craig Woolheater on next week, hopefully, to discuss that more. This week, we are glad to bring on the amazing Daniel J. Duke. Daniel J. Duke is a researcher and author, as well as long-lost relative of Jesse James. Welcome to the show, Daniel. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me on.
Hey, man, thanks so much for coming on. When Michelle, our mutual acquaintance, got a hold of me about this topic, I was like, wow, I definitely need to have him on. We have a lot of paranormal stuff on, things like that, but lost history to me is one of the most fascinating aspects of paranormal research, any research into the esoteric and literal lost histories that are out there.
It's definitely, it's never boring. It's an amazing topic. And there's a lot, there's so many rabbit holes. Once I got into this, that you could go down a million different paths.
Oh man. The rabbit holes of the Knights of the Golden Circle to begin with is mind numbing. If you think that the rabbit holes of masonry or anything like that are wild stuff and fun to read, folks, check out the Knights of the Golden Circle sometime, who Jesse James was definitely a part of. Like, that is a part of history. That's not even up to debate, as obviously his death is now. To the kerfuffle, apparently, of a lot of historians with your research, which is why I wanted to have you on. Let's go ahead and start cracking the nut here, Daniel. How did you come to find out that you were actively related to Jesse James?
The story, it was passed to me from my late mother, and it was passed to her from, when she was a kid, every birthday party, family get together, holidays, everybody talked about it. The older relatives would let, they'd start talking about, they called him Grandpa. It was my mother's great grandfather, and they would all say that he didn't die as history said he did. Yeah, that Jesse moved to Texas, changed his name, and lived to be an old man. He died in 1943 at the age of 97. And, so you grow up, my late mother grew up hearing that story. I grew up hearing the story. And mom, when my sister and I got into college, she finally had enough time to research it. And she wanted to know, the history book said one thing, her family said another. And she wanted to know which story was right. So she started doing a genealogy, going through family photographs, and my sister and I helped her. We got the photographs, and we all agreed that our photographs looked just like Jesse and some of his family members. So, but we didn't want to go on just our word. So my mom took the family photographs along with historically accepted photographs to the Texas Department of Public Safety, which is, the state police in Texas.
Yeah.
And to their headquarters in Austin. It was their forensic lab. And they verified, they had their photographic forensic analysts who verified the photos. They also used computers and all the technology available to them. They used that. They verified that our photos matched the historically accepted ones. And then we went past that. My mom took it to the Austin Police Department. Their photographic forensic analysts verified the same thing. And the third one was a company called Visionics. They ended up bought out by another company, but they were world leaders in facial recognition technology. And they also verified, so it was three different groups who verified our photos matched, and they were highly respected, highly qualified experts in their fields. So mom was excited. She took the story to Texas Monthly. They wrote an article about it, and that brought all kinds of stuff. Before Texas Monthly, actually, she called the James Farman Museum in Missouri, and they didn't want to hear anything about it. And we thought they'd be excited to know that Jesse didn't die like history stated. Yeah. And that's the last thing they wanted to hear. So there seemed to be a feeling on their side, and it's just our impression, but I can't speak for them, but they seemed to feel like it was stealing something away from them. And and at the time they were making about $7 million a year in tourist dollars in a small, poor county in Missouri. And we had a feeling money had a lot to do with that, but it was an interesting reaction.
We were having the conversation before the show, my friend. My family is from, and there is a landmark at Fred's Lounge in Mamou, Louisiana. And Bubba, Fred's is open, other than Mardi Gras and the week before Mardi Gras, it is open one day a week. It's open Saturday. That's it. And they do business butts to elbows. It blew my friends' minds to walk into this tiny little bar that's literally labeled with a plaque from the state of Louisiana as the home of Cajun music. This is where Cajun music started. So
that's cool.
Starting at 8 a.m., all you hear is bikes, just lines of bikers coming in. And you can literally pass your order and your cash to the bar, and your drink and your change comes back to you because you can't get to the bar. It's so packed.
That's so really cool.
Imagine if Lafayette came up and said, no, Jean Lafitte over here in Lafayette. You know, he was the one that came up with Cajun music.
I didn't know that.
You know, no. I'm saying imagine if that was the case. So that's kind of the situation you're in right now. Here's this tiny one red light town that there's literally a business whose whole business is based on the fact that they are the home of Cajun music. So if somebody else comes along and challenges that.
And the town I live in right now.
You know, that plaque would have to go away. That right to claim would have to go away. So, like you said, more than a little bit of money was riding on this, especially when you're talking about a small town where people are coming to pay homage to Jesse James, because he's still very much a folk hero in America and American history. So, you know, much more than stopping to see the ball of twine on the side of the road. A lot more people, I'm sure, are going to the home or the death site of Jesse James every year.
That's true.
You know,
and the death site is the one that would have hurt.
Yeah.
Just because they get just as many visitors, you know, usually people who from around the world go to the James farm where he grew up, and then they go right up the road to where he was allegedly killed.
Yeah.
And that's the one that would have hurt.
Well, and now that, you know, you've found out that you are related to Jesse James, this has been forensically shown from photographs of your family and photographs of Jesse, and you've come to this story, how did he fake his death?
Well, it wasn't on purpose. He tried to fake it. A lot of people don't realize in a couple of years before that, he purposely tried to fake his death, and it didn't go through. He had one of the gang members, George Shepherd, they'd worked out a deal. George rode into town in Oklahoma and said that he'd shot Jesse in the back of the head, and he was there to collect his reward. Well, they wanted a body, and that's where the plan fell apart on his first attempt, and that was in 1879. So they couldn't find the body, and the plan just fell apart. And there were news reports a week or two later. Some were a week later, some were several weeks later, from around the country, that Jesse had been spotted here or there, you know, things like that. And that just kind of, the whole thing fell apart. So in 1882, he had a cousin named Wood Height. It was his first cousin. And Wood Height, historically, in historical records and sources from the James family, he's bore a strong resemblance to Jesse. And even he also was part of the gang. He was in a lot of the robberies. Well, people, and that goes back to a lot of people, even the Pinkertons, who were supposedly, the best detective agency at the time in America, who were after Jesse, they didn't have an accurate description of him. So they were just going on word of mouth and description. If you ever read through the old papers on descriptions of Jesse, they vary widely. I mean, some say he was of average height. Some described him as a tall man with a fine build, and all kinds of, some said he had darker hair. Some said he had sandy hair, but anyway, Wood Height bore a strong resemblance to Jesse. He was involved in it's kind of like a love triangle between, I'm fighting not to go down some rabbit holes there, but anyway, involved in a love triangle with Bob and Charlie Ford's sister, whose name was Martha Bolton. Martha had a cabin. Wood Height would show up and, he'd check up with her for a few days and then go on his way. Well, Martha had a farmhand named Jim, who she also was, you know, they had, I guess they slept together, shacked up something, but Jim and Wood ended up in a fight. It turned into a gunfight. Woodhite shot Jim, the farmhand, killed him. And in that fight, Woodhite was run, some say he was running up the stairs, and either Bob or Charlie shot Woodhite and it hit him in the back of the head. So that was the end of Woodhite. They allegedly buried him in a shallow grave. It was during the winter when the ground was frozen. And shortly after that, and that's his death, is he was the one whose body was passed off as Jesse shortly after that. Uh-huh. I think they gave him time to thaw out and they turned it. That's the body they used. The coroner's inquest that they had during, you know, shortly after the alleged killing of Jesse, the lady, V. Mims, who was also a cousin of Jesse, who was allegedly his wife, who'd had children allegedly with Jesse, didn't know the age of Jesse James or whether or not he had a finger missing or not. But she could identify every piece of jewelry she'd ever had by memory, you know, down to fine detail, but she didn't know any details about Jesse during the inquest. And I thought that was interesting. You know, just she didn't know how old he was or whether he had a finger missing or not. And people said, well, that's because she was upset. Well, if she was that upset, she wouldn't have remembered every detail of all her pieces of jewel. Then, you know, when Jesse's mom was called in to identify the body, they brought her from Kearney, Missouri up to St. Joseph. And she walked in and said, gentlemen, you're mistaken. That's not my son. And she was walked outside by one of the women at the house. And when she came back in, she was, according to sources, very theatrical and dramatic, damning them all to hell for killing her son and, you know, just going on and on. And, but at the funeral where he was buried at the James Farm in Kearney a few days later, Jesse's aunt leaned over, and there was a lot of people there, reporters, people from all over the country. His aunt leaned over and was heard that say, that's not the Jesse I knew. And Jesse's mom shushed her and said, that's my rabbit's foot. I mean, there's a lot more to it, but, this is the cool part. The second book that I co-authored with my sister, Teresa, my sister had discovered a photo, and it shows Jesse at his own funeral standing with his mother, Zarelta. And that just blew our late mother. I wish she could have seen it because we'd always heard rumors that Jesse attended his own funeral. And I thought that would be amazing if there were a photo. We knew there were journalists there. Someone took a picture and the photo's available. It's in our second book and you can find it online. It shows Jesse standing right next to his mom, looking at the guy in the casket who is his cousin Woodhite.
Wow.
It's just the whole thing is just every step of this research for the last 25 years, from the treasures through Jesse, photos we've found, and connections he's had, is just mind blowing. And I hope I didn't run off too long and get away from the question.
No,
I'm not sure.
No, absolutely not. That was a more than apt answer to the question, my friend. It's interesting because there was more than one person, like for instance, Billy the Kid was rumored to have, who was it? Brushy Bill Roberts. Was
out
believed
in Hico,
to be,
Texas.
Yep, another person, and that's just it. Many of them fled to Texas. Texas at the time was still Mexican outpost.
Well, at that time it was Texas at that time. But it was still wild land, wild country,
yeah.
And a lot of outlaws and people looking for a new start came to Texas, especially a lot of. Like around Jesse, where he lived in Blevins, Texas, that whole area was pretty much not everybody, but a lot of the men around him were former Quantrill's guerrillas from the Civil War.
Well, and let's start exploring that real quick, because it was during the Civil War that Jesse became connected with the Knights of the Golden Circle.
That's what they a lot of people say. I've yet to find the proof. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, the Knights of the Golden Circle, and a lot of people call them the KGC.
Yep.
They were kind of like a spy organization during the Civil War. And they sided with the South. They were a Confederate spy organization. John Wilkes Booth was allegedly tied in with that. And, you know, and we all know what he did. They were very secretive. They were a spy organization. And then it's said, according to all the stories, that after the Civil War, they weren't satisfied. They wanted to get as much gold and wealth as they could to help fund a second Civil War, which kind of reminds me of rival football teams. You know, when you lose, you want nothing more than another shot at it. So and that's how I guess a lot of those guys felt. Well, but I think it goes.
Keep going.
I think it goes beyond that. It's more. I do believe there was a Knights of the Golden Circle, and I believe they probably buried some treasures.
Oh yeah,
but
no,
the treasures.
There's no doubt of the existence of the Knights of the Golden Circle.
Exactly.
That is a known historic fact. Now, granted, it's always been said that Jesse James was a high-ranking member and had worked by the end of the Civil War with his work in the guerrilla raids and leading the guerrilla troops for the Confederacy, which were truly front line, like beyond front line, the equivalent.
Yeah, Quantrell's guerrillas.
They were forces, man.
They
went in, and they sabotaged supply lines. They hijacked things. They brought the booty back home, melted the Union gold down, put Confederate stamps on it, all that stuff.
Yep.
So
it was, and you're right. There's no doubt that they existed.
Yeah.
There's no proof that I've seen or that I know of there's no proof that Jesse was actually a member. I don't doubt that he was. I just haven't found the proof. And that goes along with Albert Pike, who was also allegedly high ranking Knights of the Golden Circle.
Yeah.
There's no proof that shows he was, so I'm careful about that. I don't doubt that they were, but I also I just haven't done the proof for it yet.
Definitely fact that Albert Pike was high ranking in the Masons at the time.
Yes. And Jesse was also a Freemason.
He was. Most of the members of the Knights of the Golden Circle were Masonic. And you know, it's really interesting because, especially with the fact that their mission was to specifically take this booty gold from the Union and take it down south to Mexico and build a new army. So Texas would logically be a perfect launching point for that.
That's true. There's a part of me that wonders if the Knights of the Golden Circle weren't used by some of those men. But I mean, at the end of the war, it's natural. There's a lot of people who would want to fight again. You know, they wanted a second chance. So you use that as a means of gaining more wealth for a different purpose by a different group. And I don't know if that happened, but it's always been I've wondered if some of the men in the Freemasons didn't just take advantage of that, you know, help gain as much wealth as they could.
Oh, absolutely.
But then slip it away.
Absolutely. And I mean, there were people that played both sides.
Yeah.
You know, there were people that financially played both sides of the American Revolution.
That's true.
We actively financially play both sides of most wars going on. As a nation.
You're exactly right.
That's literally your business, Jack. When you think about it, especially when you're thinking about the active war going on, the technology at the time, and all of this gold that they are trying to literally stash to mount a second offensive later, it makes sense to go to take that gold and take it to the furthest outreaches that you can, places where telegraph is not there yet, because at that point, it's much easier to conscript people because they ain't heard a war is over yet. That's true. The news hadn't reached that small one red light, no red light town at that point. That, hey, the war's over, because there were skirmishes going on for at least a year or so after the
The
treaty was signed, because they were still depending on Pony Express, man. There was telegraph some places, but not everywhere.
That's true. Well, that's also a part of why, like Quantrill's Guerrillas, for example, Jesse was part of the Quantrill's Guerrillas. They were very good at what they did during the war. They killed a lot of people. It was small numbers versus huge numbers, and they always came out on top. There were very few small battles that they had to retreat from, but they were very good. Like you mentioned, they were like special forces of their day. But after the Civil War, the guerrillas weren't granted amnesty like the normal Confederate soldiers were. And they were outlawed, hunted down and killed if they were caught, if they turned themselves in. In fact, Jesse tried to surrender at the end of the war. And he was shot through the lung, and he got away. And somehow he lived. So he made it, and it took him years to recover. They said many years later, he would have to take his bandage off and, lance the, it was a festering sore. He'd have to lance it and squeeze the pus out. I mean, it sounds horrible, but it was interesting.
No quarter by the Union that was held on the raiders and guerrillas of the Confederacy was literally no different than the no quarter that was held on escaped slaves or freed black men who had gone to fight in the Union and were wearing Union blues like the Massachusetts 54th, stuff like that.
Yeah.
If they were seen or caught in battle, they were just killed on sight. There was no question. True. There was no court. Same thing with the white Union officers that led them. It was a flag of no quarter at that point. We see you in it. You're dead. We see
that's
you.
True.
And the Union was the same way with the bushwhackers. It was the fact of we catch you. You're dead.
Yep. That's true. And even Quantrill's guerrillas, there were a lot of stories from former guerrillas back in the day who had, when interviewed, would state that, when one of their comrades was wounded and he couldn't ride, they'd put him out of his misery right there to keep him from talking, if he were captured and tortured.
Exactly. So
they put him, it was a rough game. They fought a lot. They fought rough.
it was literally a daily amount of action. It wasn't like many other forces where it was camp and wait or hike and camp and then go fight. It was like the Texas, the Texas frontier battles and stuff. It was 24/7.
It got wild. There was something about the KGC I was going to say, a lot of people allege that Albert Pike was high up in it. Jesse was high up in several other, quite a few other people, but I have yet to find any proof that they were actually a part of it at all. That said, it doesn't mean they weren't. It's just that group was so secretive. It's hard to find anything.
Quite literally. It's kind of like Masonic tradition. There are some things that have made it out, kind of like if you look around, you can find like the rites of initiation for the Knights of Columbus. Like I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus. You can find those books of the rites of initiation and what's said and everything else.
That's true. And Knights of Columbus is the Catholic, secret society, correct?
Well, society with secrets. You just got to know the password to get in, really. What it truly is a Catholic men's service organization. We march in parades. We are actively the people. Sorry, folks. You can blame bingo night and fish fries until the Knights of Columbus petitioned Congress the Pledge of the United States did not say under God. That was put in.
Wow.
That was put in via act of Congress, by lobbying, by the Knights of Columbus. So that was not originally part of the Pledge of the United States. The Knights of Columbus lobbied to have that added. One of the many things that's out there is trivia. They are also the largest giver to Special Olympics worldwide. They also pay for all of the Pope's audio video. So when you see the papal mass being broadcast for Easter Sunday, that's the Knights of Columbus that do that. But it's just a social service organization. That's all it is. We sit around on a Tuesday night and we talk about parish business and what are we going to do for the bazaar this year. You know, are we going to do the beer booth? Well, of course we're going to do the beer booth. How else are we going to drink beer all day? All right. Well, cool. Yeah. How about the over-under table? Yeah. Well, we got to have an over-under table. Like, that's the Knights of Columbus. Welcome to it, folks. aside from that, when you get to the fourth degree and learn new passwords and maybe get a little jewel around your chest, you know, you get a cape and a chapeau. I don't think they do the sword anymore. And the chapeau is now the chapeau with the feathers is now a beret, if I'm not mistaken, for the fourth degree. Not that active right now, but that's an example of a secret society just kind of peeled open or hacked open like an onion real quick. And that's the thing is that, you know, and we get into it a little bit about the Masons in the next segment, because there's a cadre of people that say that their targeting comes from Masons. And it's like, I'm sure that there are Masons that maybe are involved, but is it the Masons? Like, is that part of their Wednesday night meeting? I doubt it. Once again, Masons would say the same thing. They are an esoteric society with secrets. They are there for those that are seeking a knowledge beyond their own, and a path That's beyond true. Their own. So it's interesting. And when you go through it, and back here on the in the Knowledge Vault is actually one of the books of Albert Pike about masonry and things.
Well,
the research
into this, I wrote this first book that, you know, the night. I can't even think right now. The treasure, my first book, the treasure book. There's so many books I've been writing lately, and other titles. Going over titles drives me crazy. but it was The Lost Treasure. Well, Jesse James and The Lost Templar Treasure. Yep. Anyway, after I wrote that, all the esoteric information, just the paths it took me down in getting, you know, trying to figure that all out. It amazed me. Kabbalah, there was Christian Kabbalah, Jewish Kabbalah. Occult Kabbalah in some cases. Yeah. There's some topics I didn't feel comfortable even going down. And I actually believe some of that was placed there to just confuse the mind of some seekers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, yes. And if you don't know what you're looking for, then I could see how it could easily throw people off.
Well, there's a part in masonry, and I want to say it's like the 31st or 32nd degree. It's right as you get up to the point of enlightened elder, in the degrees, where a lot of people leave before the 33rd degree, because when they find out these truths and the fact that all of these degrees between 13 and that were about you remembering what the hell 13's about.
Yeah.
And never forgetting what 13's about.
Well, after I wrote the first book, it led me to join the local lodge.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the Blue Lodge. And then, so I became a master mason. And then I went to the Scottish Rite, where I'm a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason.
Wow. Good for you, good for you.
Yeah, That's great. It's been interesting.
I'll bet. Yeah. I'll bet. It is an amazing journey. And I do not know a mason that doesn't love their life as a mason.
I love it. It's a lot of fun.
And
and the charities also, like you mentioned, the charity, we don't sit there on Tuesday night or the Saturday nights thinking, oh, who are we going to take over this week?
So we're all in on the Maldives, right? We're all in agreement. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
Bring out
we'll
the shrimp.
We'll take it this Monday.
That's not what's happening. And that's it can get a little rich. And I'm not saying.
Well, I remember talking about some of it,
but
we had a conversation about some of the conspiracy theories out there. You know, somebody brought it up, and we were laughing. And one of the guys came out and he said, "My God, I wish we had parties like that."
Yeah, right.
I started laughing.
Wait a minute.
It's just a bunch of old guys sitting around.
We're the partiers, and we don't have parties like that.
it's funny. I don't know where some of the conspiracy theories about that come out of, but I haven't seen that yet. So,
and
I'm sure there's plenty that come out about the Knights of Columbus as well. I'm sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'm a Shriners kid. Like I spent time at Shriners Hospital when I was a kid. So, That was a regular trip for me every few times a year. So
wow,
things like that are possible because of groups like the Masons.
Those
funny little fez hats do great things. They really, really do.
They do.
But at the same time, they do lead to the rabbit holes of things like connections with the Knights Templar, and even the fact that Jesse James was a Mason. Connection with the Knights Templar, as well as Knight of the Golden Circle, connection with the Knights Templar. Let's start getting into the Templar treasure a little bit.
All right. The best way for me to get into that is starting out where I entered the picture was helping mom, and my sister and I helping our late mother research. Along with photos and other items we have, like Jesse's diary, there was another item passed down through the family, and it was a treasure map. And who wouldn't love to find a treasure? So, but the problem with that map, even though there was encoded writing on it, and some of that eventually, it wasn't terribly hard to figure out some of it. And we finally figured out, decoded his map, and it was, several hundred in silver here, greenbacks here. But it never said, and there was gold mentioned, but it never gave any topographical landmarks or anything. It was just a geometric design, with little descriptions on different circles that he'd written on this design. And I thought, what the heck? How do we even know where to start? Because he doesn't give any directions, no coordinates, nothing. So it went from that. We were researching the Knights of the Golden Circle. And if you've researched them, and I'm sure you have, you know about that, the Knights of the Golden Circle treasure template.
Yes.
Well, that template, I don't believe was created by Knights of the Golden Circle. I think it was Masonic. I'm very convinced it was Masonic. That template is basically one sale. Lay those out on a map, just add the templates next to each other, it creates a grid system. And it's tilted at a certain degree. It's like 7 degrees off of north from where I started. It was, and this is trying to not get too far ahead of myself, in trying to figure out how that template worked with Jesse's, my up in Blevins, Texas, I was trying to figure out how you would work it. Because if you don't have a scale, it's kind of hard to figure out where, how big is it? How big is the template? There were a lot of questions. Well, former Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, he was a former Attorney General when we met him, and he's passed since, but he was interested in Jesse and the treasures as well. And he sent his driver out to pick my mother and I up and take us to several locations where large treasures had been recovered. And according to Wagner Carr, the Texas Rangers oversaw the recovery of those treasures. And I thought, wow, this is wild. But it also gave me locations on the map where I could work with the template, but not enough. The third one came from a man named George Roaming. He was a former World War II vet. He was a 32nd degree Freemason. And when he was 10, he knew, when he was a young boy, he knew Jesse when Jesse was an old man. It was right before, a few years before George went to war during World War II. Jesse had hired George and swore him to an oath to help him move 700 bars of gold about 20 miles away from his house. And George drew the map out for my mother and I on where they buried it. And so we went looking. It's on Fort Hood Military Reservation. So, you know, when we found out it's on Fort Hood property, we just stopped. We're not crossing that line. That would probably get you put, no telling what would happen to you.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
We went back to talk to George and said, yeah, it's on the military reservation now. And he just kind of smiled and shook his head. But the benefit that I got out of that, I connected that. That was the final key I needed to figure out the dimensions of the template. And after years, you know, a lot more research, I found out that template is just one. It comes in three sizes. So there's a large, medium, and small. And each one fits together, but it's representative of the, that's where you get into Kabbalah. I wanted to see why they all fit like that and who did it, what the dimensions, they seemed, the numbers, the distances, everything involved seemed esoteric. And that's what led me to Kabbalah. And that's where I found a lot of the answers.
You know, what's interesting, because I've actually got the template of the eight-pointed star. That's what you're talking mm-hmm. about, correct?
With a little, yeah, and a little, what a lot of people call bird tracks on them. There's a little, it looks like a bird's track on mm-hmm. on the template. There's, yeah.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
are actually
on the corners.
Yeah, yeah. And those, everything on there deals with Kabbalah. There's astrological symbolism involved in that. There's, it's representative of the tree of life and the grid system itself with the, it's like a veil. There's the template comes in three sizes. The way it works, it's a grid system, and it's representative of they call it the veil of the veils of negative existence. It's three veils that go in combat. They come along with the Kabbalistic tree of life. And that's another template that runs from Williamsburg, Virginia to Victoria Peak, New Mexico. And, I figured that out and I thought, oh my God, this is amazing.
Wow.
And then I started wondering how, you know, it all fit together perfectly.
Yeah. And now I'm going to hip you to something that I don't know if you're aware of or not, but there is, and if you literally Google, John Coltrane illustration of musical theory, you'll see a hauntingly similar image. I'm going to pop it up on screen right now for our listeners, and so that I can tab between the two and you can see what they look like, because they're eerily similar. While this is a eight-pointed star, the other goes into pentagonals and references points of the musical scale. And when you see these different layers on top of each other and how they overlap, it's very much the same way. And especially when you start talking about Knights Templar, that kind of stuff, they definitely had a knowledge of cymatics. They had a knowledge of frequencies and their effects.
Mm-hmm.
And to start looking,
I'm looking at the
to start looking at this eight-pointed star, because I've seen it before, but just recently I was drawing with a friend while on the road, and we were talking about just wild music theory things, and I was like, oh
yeah,
and it just popped in my head the image of John Coltrane's map, and I was like, oh, have you seen this? And as I saw this image, pop up on screen, I was like, wow, those two are eerily similar.
That is, I'm looking at it right now. It's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And to see this overlay of three forms of thought, like you were saying, kind of a meld of Kabbalah and other things. Mm-hmm. What trail did that lead you down once you finally found that there was a Kabbalistic tree of life represented across the map of America?
Well, it was several things that, well, like just researching the treasure found at Victoria Peak, New Mexico. There's people who claim Jesse was involved in burying that. I don't believe he was involved in that, but I do believe the same group, Freemason, involved with Freemasonry. I believe the same group was responsible for a lot of those treasures. But I mean, a lot of the treasures, like Victoria Peak, for example, people claim the KGC did that. People claim Jesse was a part of it. He may have been a part of it. They found treasures in there. From the treasures that were listed as being found in Victoria Peak, they ranged from old European coins and tiaras, swords with jewels on them, like royal, almost like royal jewels, to Pony Express mail bags, and then a lot of bars of gold. There was supposedly $3 billion in gold found in Victoria Peak, New Mexico. But a lot of that got covered up when White Sands Missile Range, the government kind of shot a little arrow out and encompassed that area all of a sudden. So it was off limits to people. That treasure, in fact, was mentioned in the Watergate hearings.
You know,
which just blew.
It's interesting that you say that, because that is the same thing with the supposed treasure that was found in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, I've heard the story. I've heard a lot of stories about that one too, and I'm really curious about that. But I'm trying to remember. Okay. A lot of the treasures that were buried there and in other places predated the KGC by its centuries in some cases.
Oh, sure.
So I thought, okay, if it wasn't the KGC, you know, the next logical conclusion was the Masons. So I started researching more about that. Everything I could about Albert Pike, Manly Palmer Hall. And Manly Palmer Hall led me to his wife, Marie Bauer Hall, who wrote a book called Foundations Unearthed, where she had decoded the writings of Sir Francis Bacon. And that led her to Williamsburg, where she found anagrams on tombstones. And she claimed she decoded all this, and it led her to the original foundations of the Williamsburg, Bruton Parish Church in Williamsburg, Virginia. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. Nobody believed her. People mocked her. They scoffed at the idea. And they said, no, there was no earlier church. This is the original foundation. She said, no, you're wrong. And she got permission to look for it, and she proved them wrong. Wow. Everybody who mocked her, you know, they were shocked. She decoded the anagrams written on the tombstones, and then hidden ciphers written in the works of Francis Bacon, and found the original foundation. So that shocked them. But she went further to state there was a chamber 22 feet beneath the original foundation that held treasures that were not only would affect the royal family, but also basically religious history and history as we know it. And I thought, this goes far beyond an old West outlaw faking his death. It ties into a lot more than that. And that's the one in Williamsburg, that's the head of the Tree of Life template. So after reading all that, and I figured out the template, I wanted to know why and who. And I traced, it was kind of like doing a family tree, only it's more of an organizational tree. And it led me back to Sir Francis Bacon. I thought, okay, this is the guy who started this. I'm finally satisfied. And a few days later, there was just nagging questions. And that led me to his mentor, John Dee, who was a famous Kabbalist. He was a lot of people. He was a lot of things. He's been compared to Merlin, like Merlin of the King Arthur tales. He was a spy.
Yep. He was also a heavy alchemist.
Yes, and he was also, they call him the original 007 because an alchemical symbol he used to sign his letters with, where it looked like two zeros and a seven.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, who, you know, this guy. And so I started tracking back as far as I could. Who was his mentor? John Dee's mentor. And then that man's mentor. And it led through well-known names in history, all the way back through Jewish rabbis, and finally to a rabbi known as Rashi. And in that search through some of the rabbis, there was a man named Paolo Riccio, who in 1516 rewrote a book from a former, another rabbi. I think it was Abraham. I can't remember his name right now. But Paolo Riccio published this book. Johann Reuchlin, who was a friend of Martin Luther. I mean, it went off on a lot of trails through a lot of history. But Johann Reuchlin was real interested in it. Let's see. In that book that was published by Paolo Riccio, I don't know if you're familiar with Scott Wolter and his Hooked X in America Unearthed, the show he had.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The Hooked X is very visible on the cover. It was a Kabbalistic drawing of a rabbi pointing to the floor. And in that floor, the tiles in the floor make up a map of Europe and the New World, wow, and the water between it. I thought, this is wild. I took the tiles of the floor, superimposed them over a map from the same time period, a world map from that time, and it matched perfectly with the New World and, you know, as they knew. I thought, this is wild. But I went past that. It went to the rabbi named Rashi, and he was the favored court guest of Hugh de Champagne, one of the founders of the Knights Templar. And I thought, my God, this is insane. So, you know, I wanted to write the book. I fought with myself a lot. I thought, no, I'm not going to write this. People will think I'm crazy, and I should just leave it alone. And I finally had and wrote the book, and then, you know, it got published. But I didn't know until it came out, the current head of the Knights Templar, Timothy Hogan, wrote a glowing endorsement of that book, saying that I had cracked part of the code dealing with the Templars and the treasure from the temple in Jerusalem. Wow. And that just made my day. I mean, that kind of verification, the head of the group who was responsible for it, you know, centuries earlier, saying that I cracked part of the code, just that thrilled me.
Wow, that's still getting incredible. Goosebumps thinking about it. Congratulations, Ben.
Well, thanks.
With that being said, one question I would have is, what do you do now? I mean, seriously, well, now that, because, you know, it's one of those, like, what do you do once you have the code?
Yeah, well, I thought about it, and there was a lot of thinking, deep thinking, and just basically fighting with myself for a while. But I came to the conclusion that that treasure, all the treasures, I'd love to find one. I have to admit, I would still love to find one. But I don't think I would touch it. I think it belongs. And the reason is, like Francis Bacon, for example, he wrote a book called The New Atlantis. And The New Atlantis is basically, if after reading it, I'm convinced it's a template for what America was meant to be.
Yep.
And that's what the treasures deal with. I think, well, anytime you're going to start a nation, you need wealth. You need reserves of wealth for future wars, expansion, growth, anything that deals with running a nation. And I think the treasures that were buried were originally meant to help grow, help start the country, fund the country in times of need, and maybe use it as a rainy day fund. So there's so much history behind it and so much importance. I would feel guilty if I took some for myself. And so what I did when I came to that conclusion, and I know it sounds corny, you know, it belongs in a museum kind of statement, but, I went ahead and I copied the map and I sent it to one to Timothy Hogan and one to another man who was in the Masons, the 33rd degree Mason, who I really trusted. Yeah, he's dead now, but it wasn't over that. He died of old age, but, I just felt it belonged. I knew they probably already knew about it, but I just in case I wanted to give them my findings, and that way it keeps me from, it kind of keeps myself in check, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, you literally need that, especially whenever you are, because when you, even when studying the paranormal, we have this conversation regularly on this program, whether it's the paranormal, the esoteric, what have you, there is a knee-jerk reaction that happens that you have to get past. And it's a hard hurdle to get past. And it's a hurdle where, yeah, you have to even doubt yourself and doubt the veracity of what you have in front of you. And like you said, either entrust it to somebody else to please check my work. Tell me I'm not a crazy man right now.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
Because
I worried about, yeah.
At some point, number one, you can become entirely too personally enveloped and involved, especially because, hey, it's your family. You know?
Yeah.
So it can be hard.
It's exactly right. And it's a natural tendency to put blinders on in the bias you've already built, whether consciously or subconsciously.
Exactly.
There's a bias there, and you need someone outside of that circle to check your work.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as we say on the show all the time, UFO means just that. Doesn't mean alien, doesn't mean extraterrestrial. It means it is an object flying through the air that we don't know what it is.
Exactly.
It does not mean that it's alien.
That's true.
It is literally the definition of the word. It is an unidentified object that is flying through the air. That's what it is. So researching from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have to come at it from that point of view, and you have to look at it as dispassionate, because this is science, this is research, and unless it's repeatable, it's not provable. You know, so
that's true.
There's strong belief, like, hey, I am a huge believer in the fact that yes, there is extraterrestrial life. I'm probably in the area of 65%. With the fact that our government not only knows about it, but has probably been in contact. I'm probably about 65% sold on that as fact.
I always remind, and especially after all the research I've done, I've learned it is very important to remain open-minded on things and don't close. But people, and this goes back to another topic I was telling somebody at work earlier today. If you know, I think it's human nature for when you see things, people naturally categorize everything. You put in a little box in your mind and it's neat and tidy. And when something jumps out of that box, there's that knee-jerk reaction to either disbelieve it or feel fear. There's a range of emotions people feel, but if they could learn to look at it open-minded and get used to thinking outside the box, it opens up a lot more to a person.
Absolutely. A point of datum that you add to a data set to make an educated decision is just that. It is a point of datum. Accept it. Don't accept it. Absorb it into your into your essay if you want, whatever, or don't. But the fact is, here's a nugget, and it does not exist. So you got to be willing to at least see the fact that it exists and that it's there, and not deny that.
That's true.
And even the fact of just to loop this back around of finding out forensically that, A, you are related to Jesse James, and that, B, you may well have proof that he did not die as history states.
Yeah, well, and back on that part of it, we have proven that the exhumation they did in 1995 when they that my late mother shot that full of holes, no pun intended, the James Farmer Museum wanted to prove once and for all that that was Jesse in the grave in Kearney, Missouri. And so they wanted an exhumation done with DNA testing. And it sounds, you know, off the top, it sounds great. Everybody wanted that. It, you know, if it had been done right, it could have gone a long way towards proving that he really didn't die. They wanted to prove that he did, but it would have answered questions for both sides. But what they did, they hired a law professor and something of that magnitude. When you're dealing with history, you don't hire a guy who's not an expert in the field you need. They hired a law professor, James E. Starrs, who was a law professor at Georgetown University. And that was his hobby, doing exhumations. It wasn't his profession. He didn't have a degree in it. He was just, that was his hobby. So he dug people up and tried to make a name for himself. So he dug this grave. They gave him permission. Yeah. So he did. That was his hobby. That's what he did. They hired him to do it. He comes out, makes a big show out of it. He digs up the alleged grave in Mount Olivet Cemetery and found a grave that had multiple bodies in it. There was female bones and male bones in this grave. So he couldn't even extract it. He claimed he couldn't extract DNA from any of those. So he went to the James Farmer Museum. They claimed to have a sample of Jesse's hair and one of Jesse's teeth. And that sounds simple enough on the surface, but researching that, those teeth and that hair, well, the teeth, for example, they kept in a Tupperware bowl. In 1978, the curator of the museum, just started digging up spots in the yard that was near where the original grave was. And he uncovered bones. There was a hog's tooth, a dog's tooth, a human tooth, and several other animal bones. And he kept them all together in a Tupperware bowl and passed them around to friends, stuff. So there's cross-contamination right off the bat.
A little bit.
And then the guy that the museum entrusted the bone and the alleged tooth and the hair to, where they put that in the hands of, oh God, I'm starting to forget names. Stephen Caruso. He was at the time the director of Clay County Parks Department. He was a director of the director of the Clay County Parks Department. And he had a friend, he didn't like the way the exhumation was going. He's an attorney right now. And he told my late mother and I in person, he said, the hair that they tested that they thought was Jesse's, he didn't like the way it was going. He's on film saying the exhumation was a tawdry sideshow. He didn't agree with it. He didn't like the way they were handling it. So Professor Starrs got a court order for him to turn over the hair and the teeth. And he said, I didn't agree with it. So he pulled the hair out of his friend's head, John Hartman, who was the parks director, or one of the parks directors. He pulled the hair out of John Hartman's head and submitted that. And they used that hair in documentaries trying to support that as part of their proof that that was Jesse in the grave and that he died as history stated, which is completely false. It wasn't even the right hair they tested. And he told us that the tooth they tested had similar origins. He wouldn't tell us where he got the tooth, but he just started laughing and that's all he would say. So everything they did was a sham. And then they came out to the world saying, we've proven by science that Jesse died as history said, and there's no proof at all. And the other thing, they acted like, and they stated to the press and in documentaries that they had to exhume the grave because there were no living relatives that would have the same mitochondrial DNA. Yet the whole time there was a lady named Sue Laura Hell, who everybody, there's no disagreement, she is a direct descendant from Jesse's mother. So she would have had the same mitochondrial DNA. And she was living in California at the time. She was in her 90s. Well, my mother found out. She contacted her and asked her if she would go to her doctor, if they would, you know, draw some blood and submit it through strict chain of custody. We didn't get the blood. It was delivered to a DNA expert in San Antonio who does work for the FBI and the state and local police departments. That guy tested Sue Laura Hell's blood against my late mother's blood and said there's a definite relation. It showed a relation. There was a definite relation. And not But in, to stand up in court, he wants, we would have to get permission to retrieve DNA from the graves of mom's dad and then his mom and then the alleged, you know, the grave of Jesse and Blevins. So, and test that against the alleged evidence that they had from 1995 up in Missouri.
But wow.
What I'm getting at is we've got more proof than they've ever had. All they have is basically hearsay, a pile of books that they've written to back up their claim, but there's no real evidence.
Well, and, you know, even speaking of real evidence, I'm gonna pop up the funeral picture here. That's a pretty clear face on there. That is a pretty clear face on somebody who was shot pretty well point blank range with a 44 in the back of the head. I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't blow his face off.
Funny how there's an open casket. You know?
Yeah.
That's one of the things that, like, the mafia does to assure the fact that mom's going to have a closed casket for you.
Exactly. And there was a gun expert, yes, with the state police in New Mexico, a lady, I can't remember her name right now. She's a firearms expert. She reenacted that as best she could, yeah, the way it was described, the way the shooting was done. And she said, even if you loaded it with half the powder, yeah, in an old black powder, yeah, pistol, it would still have blown off a large portion
even
of his face.
It was smooth bore.
Yeah. And they claimed, yeah, it was in everything about the way it was claimed to have gone down. Has been proven to be false, the way the traditionally accepted history claims it. And and the thing is, and we always had to keep reminding ourselves, it would make me mad. We'd get frustrated. My late mother would get mad and frustrated, but we would have to, we would always remind one another that Jesse's the reason that lie was put out there. It was so he could fake his death. And he needed a good lie, and that was a very good lie at the time. Nobody had an accurate description of him, so all they needed was people to say, yeah, that's Jesse. And the only people who could verify who it was their family and his close friends who were also gang members. So if they, you know, and he trusted, they all trusted each other more than anybody.
And I guess, the word of a murderer.
Yeah,
that's the word. True. That's the word that you should just immediately trust. You know.
Yeah, and like, well, and
hey,
they
I just
were
killed this
they,
guy. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, how about a little bit more inquest?
Yeah. Well, later on, when just researching more into it, like his family connections, Jesse was cousins with Governor Crittenden, who was governor of Missouri at that time.
Oh, wow.
He was also related to the Sheriff Timberlake, who was from Clay County, Missouri, which is where Jesse grew up. Timberlake would chase Jesse, but never catch him. There was another sheriff he was related to. It was Courtney. And Courtney owned, there was a lot of sheriffs in that area and powerful people, law enforcement, a lot of different people who Jesse was directly related to. And he was also related to LBJ, distant cousins with President LBJ.
Wow.
And LBJ's, I don't know if you've ever heard of Billy Saul Estes.
Yep.
He was a famous Texas con man. Some people say he killed people for LBJ. I don't know how true that is. There's no proof. But he was also related to Billy Saul Estes. I met Billy Saul in person at an exhumation of a grave in Granbury, Texas, years ago. And the funny thing about that, Wagner Carr always claimed he didn't know Billy Saul at all. Wagner Carr was at that exhumation too, and Billy Saul and Wagner were back in the corner of the cemetery, just laughing and talking and having a great time. And they didn't know one another. I thought that was really interesting.
Wow. Wow.
There's a lot of fun little that that's kind of off the topic, but I don't know why it's been a wild ride.
It's literally a prime example of the rabbit holes that you end up going down when when you're researching something like this, because something turns up and sure enough, you know, the family tree pops up. And whenever you're doing your family tree and that pops up and he's in there, like, yeah, the others are going to pop up too, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's like a multiple spider webs overlaying one another. And if you, you know, you touch one thread, it shakes all the others. And it, once you think you've solved it, all it does is uncover even more mysteries. And it's addictive. I don't think the average human life is long enough. I wish I could live 1,000 years at least, just so I could have more time to research every part of this.
I'm the same way. Like I told the audience earlier, there's two bookshelves back here full of books, and I can't not read it. Like when COVID started, my obsession was alchemical texts. I was downloading PDFs like crazy and reading like a couple hundred page alchemical codexes and things like that. Just
same here. I know what you
wild
mean.
Wild esoteric stuff. That's like, what is this? This is just fascinating. And it's hard not to keep going, you know, but once again, to know that you have tempered yourself in your research, especially it being as close to home as it is. That's mm-hmm. fantastic to hear. So, next steps for you, what can we see next? When is, I guess you have a new book that just came out, correct?
That's right. It was, this one's titled, and I believe that's the last Jesse book I'll write. I can't see how it could go further. I don't count it out, but the title of the third book is The Secret History of the Wild Wild West. And it subtitles Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites. That's where I list a lot of the family trees tying in Jesse to a lot of well-known people. He was also related to Bickley, who was one of the founders of the KGC.
Oh, wow. Well, you have it.
So, I mean,
hence a reason for, once again, his rumored rise to the cream of the crop. To the top.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I mean, you know, in my first book, I discount the KGC, not completely, but quite a bit. In my mind, they played a very small role, and I still think they played a small role, but there was it's bigger than I thought it was. And I think it was more Freemasonry and Rosicrucians, and probably a lot of, well, throughout history, it was, I believe, mostly Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and there were, well, a lot of Kabbalists, Christian, occult, and Jewish Kabbalists.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And that is an episode in and of itself that I would love to talk with you about. I want to thank you for your time tonight. This was a fantastic conversation, both
I had a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
And during the show. Hey, you are welcome back anytime you like. I look forward to actually meeting you upcoming in Marshall.
I do too.
Before we let you go, Daniel, it is time for shameless self-promotion. So let everybody know where they can go to buy your books. Let everybody know where they can go to follow you online, social media, where they can go to get the latest and greatest blogs, if you do that kind of thing. Give everybody where to go to keep up with you.
Okay. Yeah, my website is danDukeAuthor.com. My late mother's website is JesseWJames.com. You can find the books anywhere. I'm also, if you Google Dan Duke or Daniel Duke and author, you'll find me. You'll be able to find my Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts. My publisher is Inner Traditions, and I'm very grateful to them. And my book's available basically anywhere books are sold. It's all over the world, except for probably North Korea and a couple of other small places. But yeah, you can get it anywhere. Yeah. So, and I don't mean to leave out my sister. My sister, Teresa F. Duke, she co-authored the second book with me, which was The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James.
Oh, wow. Well, once again, I want to thank you for your time tonight. I am glad that we finally got a chance to connect and get you on. I want you back on again and again and again.
Thanks. I'd love to be back.
This is a fascinating topic, and once again, the more you dig, the longer the rabbit hole gets. It's just absolutely amazing. So,
it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. I will make sure to share links to everything whenever it goes out live to all platforms tomorrow. We were live to a couple tonight, but here in a little while during the pre-record segment, I will be pushing it out to all audio platforms. So I'll be sharing links to that for you and everything else. So
thanks.
Take care of yourself, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. You too. And I enjoyed this greatly. Oh, and when you get to Marshall, let me know. My office, by the way, is in the convention center.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm pretty easy to find.
All right. Well, I'll find you. Trust me.
All right.
Well, you take care of yourself. All right.
You too. And take care. Bye.
All right, Daniel.
Thanks.
Take care, man. What an amazing conversation. The book, folks, is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. Go buy it. I'm telling you right now, it is some of the most amazing reading that you can find while you are online checking out all the amazing work of Daniel Duke. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is the home for all episodes. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault. Hot tip, everybody who is listening live right now, head over to Declassified Programs and pull up Operation Northwoods, pull up MK Ultra, and pull up Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. Those are some of the things that we will be bringing up on screen during our next segment. Right after commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, whistleblower and author of the book, How to Tame a Demon, the amazing Dr. Robert Duncan, coming up right after this, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests.
Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. And welcome back, everybody. This segment, we are going to be getting into some fantastic conversations about targeting technologies, different technologies that are out there that can manipulate brainwaves from a distance and even cause harm from a distance. We'll be getting into that in just a second. I'd like to once again thank our awesome sponsor, the secret of everything, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. She is your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion exercises. Make sure to stop on by and check her out at secretofeverything.com. Of course, our good friends at WebWorks Wireless as well. WebWorks Wireless is your source for high-speed internet. We have been using WebWorks Wireless since the beginning of Curious Realm. I am here to attest to the no data limits, no throttling, and no contracts. Quite literally, I put up gigabytes, about 20 gigs worth of data a month through my WebWorks wireless system. Never a problem anywhere across the country with live feeds, with uploads, downloads, what have you. Stop on by and check them out. WebWorksWireless.com. Of course, while you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by Amazon and check out the books How to Tame a Demon as well as Project Soul Catcher. They are the work of our good friend and guest, Dr. Robert Duncan. He also has a document here on our knowledge vault. If you go to curiousrealm.com/knowledge, you can go to Declassified and you can find some amazing work by Dr. Duncan as well. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Duncan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for inviting me back. We always have great talks, and we never know which vault door we're going to open.
well, and that's what I love is that your range of experience is so vast. And when it comes to targeting technologies, when it comes to the algorithms to real-time process that kind of data, and even what it takes to be able to insert dreams and read dreams. You were right at the forefront of all that technology as it happened. So to be able to lean on you with topics like this, like Havana syndrome, things like that, I greatly thank you for your time, anytime that you have time to come on. So,
well, thank you.
Well, speaking of, let's get right into it. Not too long ago, actually had the opportunity to sponsor the International Remote Viewing Association and had a great conversation with John Brandenburg, specifically about the word demon and demon, however you want to say it. One of the many words used for algorithms and things like that that call home. Let's start getting into some of your work in How to Tame a Demon, a short and practical guide to organized intimidation, stalking, electronic torture, and mind control. Because it's a thick topic. Whenever you mention Havana syndrome, which is, I guess, what most common people would know this as, at least as of right now, is Havana syndrome. However, there have been people for decades who are known as targeted individuals, who claim to be targeted by microwave weaponry, claim to be targeted by electronic means. So let's start getting into a little bit of this.
All right. And there's a big conspiracy around that because it has been going on for so long. And people have been crying out for help and demonstrating in front of the White House and Capitol and writing their Congress people and to no avail. I personally went with the head of the LA FBI, spoke to 23 representatives, congressmen, and the Senate Intelligence Committee. And we got a lot of lip service that they were interested and would get back. MK Ultra clearly never stopped the testing on the worldwide public, and that's for many reasons. I mean, this is the next frontier of war without blood, silent war. People only get upset if they see blood or explosions. And if you can destroy the enemy without any of that, you're one step ahead. What if you have control of nuclear weapons? You can control the minds of those who have their fingers on it. So it's a game changer, to say the least. But Havana syndrome popped up in the news, a few years ago. And because of Havana, Cuba, diplomats were coming down with these weird symptoms. Now, which is funny because we've been talking about these symptoms for decades. I personally have been an activist for about 25 years. And only when Intel people, government officials, diplomats, if you want to call them, but they're mostly spies, were attacked, did it bring attention to the news. And they then named it Havana syndrome. But it's happened in several embassies around the world.
Absolutely.
And it's something also unfortunate is, I mean, it got recognition. That's good. That's a start. But they're only compensating not the public who complains about it, but just the diplomats. They're compensating them their full pay in disability. And whoever is behind it, and let's just leave that as a whoever at this point, but only Russia and the U.S. and now China have the technology. And a lot of people claim no, rogue criminal organizations have it. And this is worse than the atomic bomb. We're not going to allow this technology, nor do they have the capability to do it. Now, you can build small microwave weapons to fry people's organs while they sleep, their brains, their hearts, cause them cancer, with X-ray directed energy weapons. The FBI busted a group that was trying to build one. But that's not the real topic. The real one is far worse and more devious, and that is a psychological manipulation of the mind to create Manchurian candidates to persuade voting. So you can't have a democracy. You can alter people's minds while they're sleeping or while they're watching TV. At least with watching TV, sure, that's a huge propaganda, you know, form to control people. But we at least have our conscious brains that we can decide whether to accept the information or dig deeper or something like that. But we can actually control the emotions, the subconscious, while a person dreams. And so when they wake, it percolates up to their conscious state. And it's the brain is very complex, but we've deciphered it on the most part. But back to Bandit Syndrome, just recently there was a CNN report that was on television. I think it was this last Sunday, a special report. And it didn't really have much new to say other than a doctor who was investigating it, a CIA doctor, came down with the exact same symptoms what he was trying to research. And so, you know, that makes it newsworthy. But I'm going to be honest with you. I believe this is an Operation Northwoods because we're preparing for war with Russia, then with China, and, you know, conquer the world with the New World Order. And so in order to get the public behind some common enemy, Operation Northwoods was about Cuba, ironically, of faking Cuban terrorists to attack the U.S. And it was a top secret document, but it got declassified. And if your listeners haven't read the document, please look it up. Just to show you how devious government can be.
Oh, absolutely. I'm actively bringing it up on our Knowledge Vault as we speak. We have the Operation Northwoods documents, and not many people realize that within that was also included Operation Mockingbird, which was control of the media and putting out messages through the media. Repeating messages through the media.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we humans are like that. We don't have a lot of time to do critical reasoning, and so we tend to take on the opinions that we're told either through the hypnotube or our friends or whatever it may be.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it really is also the it's not hard to hijack the brain. As you were talking about earlier, prime example, and audience, you can get upset with me if you like. The cortisol stimulation that happens to people who actively listen to 4 hours of Alex Jones. There is a cortisol level that goes on whenever you listen to anything like that that inflames you, be it listening to the news that you listen to and only that strain of news, and not reading and hearing and filtering other sources. It really does create a cortisol junkie and somebody that is easily manipulated. And once the cortisol level is up in the brain, as opposed to serotonin, that control is so much easier to maintain. The cycles of the brain get disturbed much easier. The sleep cycle gets disturbed much easier. And
you're completely right. And it even affects how well we remember something. And we can go on to a higher level, and why are we always in a state of panic on the mainstream media? Why is our government always promoting the next big terror, from terrorists to, you know, World War III to COVID to, we always have to have a common enemy, as President Reagan said, in order to keep the population together and fighting one enemy. So a lot of these enemies are imaginary and we create them. But serotonin, yes, that's, you want that. But I was an adrenaline junkie when I was young. I did 23 skydiving jumps. You know, I love the thrill.
Oh, adrenaline it up all day long, because adrenaline, you know, I mean, there's an association with fear there, but there's also exhilaration tied with that. There is also utter enjoyment tied with that. Like this whole studio here behind me, I was running on adrenaline all day long, wiring all this up and getting it done, because that's what I love. You know, that's a serotonin up.
Yeah,
for me to go and read the news and read the news and read the news all day, or listen to the news incessantly all day. It's hard, and give it a shot, folks. I guarantee you, number one, turn on any radio station, except for like public access, things like that, like Pacifica Radio, not going to happen. But if you turn on a top 40 station, guaranteed you will hear about 2 hours of programming repeated all day long. The same songs over and over and over. These are the hits all day. And for instance, back in the day when I produced for Alex, we had 5 monitors of news going on 24/7. And by the time anybody would show up at 9 a.m., I showed up at about 6 and started recording things and stuff like that as they happened. But by the time 9 or 10 came around, it was on repeat. Unless there was a breaking news item happening, a major event, or something like that, or the president broke in for an announcement or State of the Union or something like that, it was the same news stories all day long, covered by different people putting out the same diatribe.
Yeah, it's an echo chamber.
Yeah.
And it's controlled, and that's Project Mockingbird, as you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah. And I mean, it really does start there. Because once you've got control of the media, you've once again got control of people's biology to begin with. Even if you start going into the flash frames of a television, you know, back in the day, and I'm sure much more in your day, doctor, but I remember hearing from my mom, like, back away from the television, quit watching that thing so much. It's going to make you stupid. You know, called the idiot box for a reason, you know, and quite literally 30 frames per second, you know, one frame out of 30, you're not going to see it. And we have laws that are literally written to stop subliminal advertisement, because that's it true. Used to happen in film. Regularly, back in the days of, you know, the newsreels, stuff like that, you know, let's all go to the lobby. In the middle of it, they'd flash drink Coke, stuff like that. And Coca-Cola paid for that. And then it's like, yo, wait a minute, you're manipulating people's brains here in this advertisement. And that's not okay. So we made laws for that. But for some reason, for the technology that allows people to be able to target folks with microwave weaponry, the technology to break into people's dreams and basically hack in and either record, literally they have recorded dream already, and then be able to play it back. And be able to actively converse with somebody in a dream state. Like,
you got it.
The dreamer hears you. This is within the last year and a half that it has been announced that that happened. I want to say at your alma mater of MIT.
Yeah. No, the technology is very old, unfortunately. But what I'd like is to encourage the civilian scientists to catch up. So then maybe we can have a discussion in our country, around the world. Is this really a path we want to take? And, but, you know, first it has to be used for war, and it has to be used for interrogation. So the dream hacking was best described by a movie called Inception, where you can literally pull out people's passwords and pull out their PIN codes while they're sleeping. And because all our filters are down, we're in a different reality state.
Well, and not only that, it's the fact of the amount of data that you could gather and garner from an individual, especially in the world of clandestine work, mainly because our dreams are an unfiltered tap into exactly what happened to us that day. We go through and we emotionally process all of the things that we just autonomically went through.
Now, what if you can alter those emotions and alter the dream slightly?
Yeah.
So let's say I'm not going to use any names, but you to vote a certain way. Well, I could put in your dream, you know, fear associated with that image. And that will percolate up to your consciousness, your awake state, eventually. And so democracy doesn't exist. In fact, with this technology, you want democracies in order to have a technocracy. And it's or whatever term you want to use. But it's scary because this is being squelched so much in the media. And it's only coming out now, but people don't understand the technology or it's in disbelief. I have free will. I have my own agenda. I can't be hypnotized or influenced. And they're wrong. And they're just simply wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you may not be susceptible to a stage hypnotist.
Exactly.
However, I assure you, given enough subliminal message with binaural beat going on behind some music that plays in your office every day, oh, I bet within a week I could have you craving pepperoni pizza twice a day.
Exactly.
Guaranteed. It is not difficult. When you combine a couple of technologies like the Monroe Institute work with binaural beats and things like reverse speech and other subliminal techniques that are out there.
Yeah, if you get into the philosophical realm of what is a human being, there is no firewall for the human mind because we are learning creatures. And so what, are you going to grow up in a sensory deprivation chamber?
Yeah.
No, it's part of our very nature to be influenced. So it's very difficult to think of what even a firewall would represent. Turning off your television? Okay, maybe, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, even considering the statement that you just made, we crave to be influenced. You know, it really does speak a lot to the algorithms out there of Facebook, Twitter, all that kind of stuff. You know, we forget that Facebook, and hey, I leverage Facebook, man, like crazy. I leverage Facebook. I am hashtag shameless in my leveraging of Facebook. Well. All right. However,
he's a Harvard grad, and I call them every name in the book. So, and I've only been in Facebook prison probably 4 or 5 times. So.
Well, and it you know, it's funny because people forget the fact that A, they got the Facebook got their initial round of funding from InQtel.
Yeah.
Which I'll pop up on the screen here in just a minute. But they are the financial arm of the CIA who actively goes out and looks for burgeoning technologies that can be used for CIA work, be it black hat, white hat, what have you.
And that originally, Facebook was a project in the DOD called LifeLog. And then once the technology we work on is kind of secure, we think we figured out how to use it, then it's funded by QIntel or others to be released into the civilian sector. Again, I worked on a project for the CIA that was a predecessor to Google. And again, that's another one that we had to make sure everything, we know all the possible outcomes. Well, now with mind hacking, brain hacking, literally phone calls from brain to brain at the speed of thought and transmitted at the speed of light, there are a whole bunch of issues we got to work out. So in my next book, I talk about the details of the topologies, and that just means networks that they're experimenting on, with brain to brain to machine to brain, different types of configurations. And people will think, oh no, that's science fiction. Well, you go to Duke University, they do physical brain implants with monkeys, and they can solve problems as a single mind in a hyperintelligence that a single monkey cannot do. So, you know, they're coming along in the universities, but they're not allowed access to illegal human experimentation yet.
And once again, I mean, I've got up a bio site right now that puts out technology like that. Like I've got a Muse band, a Muse headband. I can actively see and live track all of my brainwaves.
Yeah. I wrote a program that I could play a musical, only eight notes, an octave, with my brain, just through this neurofeedback system.
Wow.
I could play Marietta Little Lamb or something, but it wasn't.
I need to talk to you about that and get a copy of that. Because I actively had a app for a little while that would turn my brainwaves into MIDI, and then it just crashed and stopped working, and I can't find another one anywhere. And it blew my mind, some of the music that I made, because I would actively do one blank track where it was just my brain doing its thing and all that. Then I would, on the second track, play that back through a visualization program and watch it and listen to it, and then record my brainwaves again. So the second track,
the bidirectional feedback.
It was wild to see what music my brain would actively make as a result of watching the music.
Yeah, I call it the music of the mind. So imagine all your micro macro circuits and a big orchestra. And you could listen to it with feedback through your ears and see it through your eyes.
Yeah.
You can create some incredible stuff, but to go back to the dream recording, well, that's even more powerful because you're using the cerebral cortex.
Yep.
And you're grabbing the big picture. And people think, well, how can you grab audio if it's less, the brain operates at 2 kilohertz or less? It's because they have the cognitive model. If you have the cognitive structure and model, then you can send a type of encrypted data, so to speak, that only will work for that person or for that species.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and much like heterodyning and EEG, like Dr. Hall talks about regularly, that kind of technology, it is no longer incredibly difficult You know, at one point it took millions of dollars of technology to do such things, and that is no longer the case.
And I want to add, I think I coined the term EEG header dunning, but I don't want people to forget about MEG, which is magnetoencephalographing. They are in combination use, and I run neural network models to show how they give slightly different information, but are both important, the magnetic field as well as the electric field of the brain.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it, because quite literally our brain is a transducer. So much like it can send a frequency, it can receive a frequency. And, you know,
people don't understand that our brains are a microchip itself. It is. Yeah. It's an electromagnetic system, and our consciousness and our mind is just the signal information, the software, if you will. They have trouble jumping between the objective realm and the subjective experience of being human.
Well, and, you know, even to try and unweave that matrix of being human, not being human. For years, I followed the work of remote viewing and the Stanford Research Institute, things like that.
Right.
Recently, I had the opportunity to sponsor the International Remote Viewing Association conference. And it was not until I attended and interviewed people and sat and had breakfast with folks like Hal Puthoff, John Brandenburg, every single person involved with the beginnings of that science. And say what you want, folks, it is a science. It is scientifically proven. Every single person is a PhD in like particle physics, things like that. And for them to literally accept the fact, not only philosophically, but scientifically,
yes,
that we can exist in two places at the same time, that we can literally gather information and data from a remote source.
So we are bathed in the Earth's magnetic field. That is the common field, as well as from ground to the ionosphere creates an electric field. And most high energy physicists would say that's all you need to turn the Earth into a gigantic MRI machine. And so they're totally right that this can be done. In fact, Dr. Persinger, out of Canada, before he died, he wrote a paper, How to Control 8 Billion Brains on Earth or something like that. He sent me all his latest papers right before he died. And his scientific language was odd, but he was definitely on to something. And so I felt very privileged that he did that for me.
Well, and to see that kind of data, even yourself, at the advanced level that you're at, I understand a lot of these things in a very glazed over aspect and can connect dots in my brain between technologies and how they could work together and cross paths. That's all I can do. I literally, just so you know, folks, all these books in the background, there's like another shelf just as big over on the other side. Sure, I've read them. I hold no degree, man. Like...
Life is about learning.
A lot of people go to school for 8 years. Most of them are called doctors. However, the information is out there. It is now public knowledge. These things are all the things that I've been bringing up, MIT, everything else, that is within the last year. So this is all active research based on things that have been going on for decades.
In fact, the U.S., I get Department of Defense, you know, memos and newsletters and stuff. And they're banning companies from China that are working on brain technologies and mind control. So China's very big into it as well, because this is the next frontier, the next network of hiving everyone's mind together into some kind of network or unit. And that's my next book is called The Birth of a New Species. And it's the volume 3 of Secrets of Cyber and Cybernetic Warfare Revealed. And it's very much what's going to happen. Now, I'll look like a prophet, but I'm actually speaking as a historian in the book.
Well, even speaking as a historian in that, right, there is once again a panoply of stuff out there. And when you look at not only the research that you have done, the work that you have done, the algorithms that literally you helped write, that were the foundation of so many things that are out there and used now. You know.
Yes, but mine was, you know, and you're making me feel guilty.
Don't feel guilty. You did work, man. What the monsters who paid you did with that work?
Yeah.
You know, exactly. like your name's on a patent. That's it. It's not like you got paid like gobs of money from the patent.
No,
that's not what working in a lab is about. Just so you all know, like, your name gets to go on a patent, but the lab that you work for makes all that money. You make your rate.
Yeah, well, and some of the agencies, they don't allow patents.
Precisely, because if you patent it, then, you know, number one, now it's public and they don't have a 10-year jump on it, which is what they want at a minimum is a decade jump on the technology.
Minimum, yes.
You know, just so you know, anything that you see that flies overhead, folks, like, that was at a minimum developed 10, 15 years ago. Most computers that you were pulling off the shelf, that technology is now 10 years old.
So true.
And you know, the average consumer doesn't realize that, you know, and just so you understand the web, I think it was 2012 that the head of Samsung came out and said, yeah, there's microphones in your TV and they're listening to you. That's how we push, you know, ads in your local area for things that you like. You know, programmatic advertising.
It does make me giggle when the conspiracy theories end up being true.
Well, sometimes life is stranger than fiction. Yeah. You know, even be it science fiction. And on that note, to go back to the full-on topic of targeted individuals, because we of course have quite a few that listen to the show and are involved in our online communities, I pray for every one of these people because their life has been so interrupted. Yet at the same time, there are some claims that are pretty large, and like you said, yes, it may be in the hands of some specialized contractors. It may be in the hands of some other people who have done, quote, wet work or other black bag work for alphabet agencies. Granted. However, there's quite a contingent of folks, and I'm no expert. I don't know, but who claim Masonic involvement with the technology, who claim to be targeted by Masons, claim to be targeted by the New World Order, things like that.
I've interviewed over probably about 2,500 people.
Wow.
And I've heard every story you could possibly imagine of who they believe is behind it. And that's just part of the psychological warfare. You don't want them to be able to point the finger, this country, this government, this agency specifically. A lot of them say it's Satanists or witches or demons, you know, from another realm or things like that. And I believe, you know, I'm probably going to get a lot of slack for this, but
as will you.
But no, this, it's like allowing atomic weapons in the hands of civilians. We're not going to allow it.
Yeah.
And that's my final stance on the issue. Then people say, well, they put me on a list because they have military contacts and things like that. That I can't really comment on. The only thing I've found in common is it tends to be the outlying thinkers. Now, all governments want to herd or shepherd the people. I mean, government in Latin means governor, to steer, meant of the mind. So mind steering, you know, mind control. So it surprises me when people think that some group like Masons are behind it, and they have secret club and they have these secret weapons and they're targeting non-Masons or, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, but. and same. And, you know, hey, I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus. I'm sure some of the people I'm sure some of the people involved with this scheme going on with all of this tech are Knights of Columbus, you know. But that doesn't mean that the Knights of Columbus are targeting you.
Exactly.
The two don't necessarily shake hands in that logical step.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, I get a lot of flack because I don't, you know, I already went to Congress, realized the legal system, legislature, it's human laws are all just bull.
Yeah.
And unless you have someone who can or are willing to enforce it, the Constitution is what's supposed to be protecting these people. You don't need more laws. Torture is illegal, no matter how it's done, psychologically, through mind or perception, anything.
Yeah.
So I don't think more laws are going to help. It might help bring awareness. But, you know, I think it's just public awareness, and when it happens to them, if they reach the Pentagon document says a revolution can happen if something so atrocious, you know, we do reaches 6 to 8% of the population. So that gives them a lot of leeway for human experimentation.
Well, and you know, there as we discuss regularly with Dr. John Hall, there is no law that prevents experimentation on the public.
Well, except the, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. Sure, sure. That's a great preamble and a beautiful statement. However. And when you marry that with the fact that America, as of right now, is one of the only countries that has zero definition of digital identity.
Yeah.
You know, like all these cookies that you see pop up, all these cookie trackers and stuff, where it's like opt in. That's all the EU that made that happen, that said, no, no, no. You have a digital ID. You have a digital footprint. That is yours. It is unique. And if you want people to get that, you need to opt into sharing it.
Yeah.
And you have to be open with the fact that you were collecting data to push ads and everything else.
Yeah. I worked on a lot of biometric systems, you know, vascular signatures, retinal patterns, fingerprint, voice patterns and stuff like that. But even walking gaits, which I thought was interesting. But really, they're going to push some sort of microchip onto people, digital caps. And everyone said, no, they'll never do that. I think it's closer than they think.
There has been some incredible technology, even what you're talking about right now, the new surveillance technology in China can recognize a person by their gait. By their walk and out of a crowd of thousands.
Yeah, and even if you use Doppler radar, people have unique heartbeat signatures and breathing patterns. So you can get somewhat of a recognition system, identification from that. But you combine all these different methods that I mentioned, it becomes incredibly accurate. So that's without a microchip. Now imagine if you could put or use the body's natural resonance signatures, biomagnetic and electrical signatures.
Sure.
You got, you know who the person is. And that's, maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad.
You can pick it up right here.
Yeah, well, then, yeah, we
carry everybody's already carrying the device to do it.
Yeah. That was the beginning. It's going to get much worse. When that's like, implanted you can, in your brain.
You can put in voice stress analysis. You can put in all kinds of things. I remember a conference that I worked when I first moved to Austin. It was in 2012. It was a white hat hacking conference put on by the University of Texas. I remember there was a lock picking demonstration. There was one guy, that was the first time that I saw somebody live hack on stage, and he hacked in to a home computer via a Bluetooth controlled light.
Oh my goodness.
And this was like in the early days of like, oh, I can change my lights with my phone, you know? And yeah, with that Wi-Fi and Bluetooth enabled light, he got into the actual computer on stage.
That is,
it was pretty incredible. And to see that done live was like, wow.
I accidentally, I'm not a white hat hacker. I'm not a hacker at all. But I accidentally hacked into, one of the top five, banks in the world. And wow. I wrote to them. Well, I called them and wrote to them. And they immediately fixed it and sent a thank you letter. But I kind of threatened them. I said, if you don't fix this, I'm going to release this. You
know? I'm going to let everybody know your back so door, guys.
They fixed it right away. But well, you would expect they'd have better security. And it was truly by accident that I discovered it, you know.
Well, and that kind of hack and work is done regularly now. It used to be something that, you know, every, you know, maybe thousandth coder was into.
Yeah.
My God, man, I've seen audio engineers I know hack into people's Wi-Fi systems. Like while they're engineering a show, just cause like they're bored and that's their jam, you know, like, yeah, I like finding people's Wi-Fi hotspots on their phone and just cracking into them.
See, and that,
and it's like, what?
Well, I know. It's like, oh, I tried people's doors and I found a door that wasn't locked. So I walked into their house and, you know, I just think that I'm not into the hacking thing, you know?
Yeah.
I just think that's too much of an invasion of privacy. and you can, you know, mess with people too badly.
With that being said, and with the brain hacking being said, and with targeted individuals on the radar and now in the public eye with Havana syndrome, what can those that are targeted, those that are affected by Havana syndrome do? Now, granted, those affected by Havana syndrome have been hit with the, quote, immaculate concussion. They actively show soft tissue brain damage.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that can't be repaired.
There is no repair for that. However,
for these neural weapons, think of it like Star Trek. There's a stun. There's a concussion, or there's a kill option. You know, it's dial-in lethality, as the military calls it. And unfortunately, those with the true concussion damage, it's going to continue and get worse. And so what can they do is hopefully, if they're civilian, keep going on shows like yours or others. And Dr. Len Baer, he got one of the first diagnoses of Havana syndrome as a civilian. And you know, he doesn't get compensation necessarily for it, but it's a start for all the people that have been affected over, you know, decades, and to get help. And the other problem is, though, if everyone got $1 million for compensation, it would bankrupt the United States. So that's why they've limited it to just the people who are actively on duty as, you know, for the U.S. government. But that's hardly fair. It's two classes of citizens, basically.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, this doctor is now officially the first civilian. Everybody else has been now granted, if I'm not mistaken, they, whenever the panel happened, and the original stuff.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, there were stories of some of the ambassador's children who may have been affected. They were still looking into that at that point. That was when it wasn't a panel. I guess it was more of a panel. It was done at TSU right up the road. Yeah. And
here's the thing that bothers me. We've known about these weapons easily since 1960s. You know, we've been working on them. I've worked on them, et cetera, et cetera. And when Havana syndrome comes out, it takes years to go from crickets were causing it,
yep,
to maybe a sonic weapon next year, and then maybe a microwave weapon the next year. They just didn't ask the right people. You know,
yeah,
it's like they're delaying the game, and they're purposely trying to, you know, confuse the situation. We already know what it is.
Well, and once again, remember that timeline that we were talking about, folks, wanting to be a decade ahead of the game?
Uh-huh.
Beginning in 2017, 5 years.
Yeah.
Five,
so my personal take on it is, I take Operation Northwoods and Havana Syndrome, and I put them together, and we're trying to create a pretext for war against the Russians. They must be behind it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, even right here, I've got the Operation Northwoods document up right now from our knowledge vault. Facts up bearing on the problem. Number two, it is recognized that any action which becomes pretext for the U.S. military intervention in Cuba will lead to a political decision, which would then lead to military action. Which is where the money happens.
Mm-hmm.
It always leads back to the money.
It does, because we're a war economy, admit it. I mean,
yeah,
we spend 10 times more, I mean, more than the next 10 countries combined. If there were world peace, you know how many people would be unemployed and out of business?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, my wife is not a conspiratorially minded person. She does not have that much deep faith in humanity. She doesn't think that many people can get together in a room, decide on something, and just keep it secret for like decades.
Well, it's not secret if you read the right, you go to the right research.
That's true.
If you just turn on your television, no, they control that.
Yeah. Yeah, that dialogue is just about fully controlled. And, you know, one of the things that I said whenever the laws went through and the FCC, the internet became under FCC control.
Yeah.
And under FCC purview, not control, but purview. And I was like, that's a dangerous legal precipice, because you have not gone through and rewritten the charter of the FCC. So all the FCC.
What do you think about the Ministry of Truth?
well, that already exists on the way out, and I am as purple as you can get, folks. I am not a red guy. I'm not a blue guy when it comes to politics. I think that they are all just as guilty and dirty as the next and the other. Yeah. And but Obama, on his way out in the National Defense Authorization Act, the last one that he signed, put forth funding for the office, National Office of Anti-Propaganda Propaganda. And I was like, so basically you funded a propaganda office?
Yeah.
You could call it anti-propaganda propaganda if you want. I'm pretty sure it's still propaganda.
And then the Patriot Act by Bush, I think, Jr.
Well, and you know, when you start talking about Operation Northwoods, that is of course the first thing that comes to mind. That is what a lot of people said when it came to inside job with 9/11 was, go back and look at Operation Northwoods. This is a means by which to continue the industrial military complex, and continue it in perpetuity as long as the big T word is used.
Yeah, and that's right. So let's say, hypothetically, we have one world government, one new world order. We're still going to have outbreaks, and they're just going to call them terrorists rather than countries fighting each other. And they're going to control every human to make sure they can't even form an opinion or to form a group to even overthrow this global tyranny. And I'm very anti-New World Order, and I'll be honest with that. You know, I do see mankind eventually getting along, but not the way it's being rolled out.
When it comes to New World Order, I almost fall in my wife's camp of, I don't think it would be that big. However, is there a cabal of people that are moving these things in the background? You're darn tootin'.
Oh, Klaus Schwab, Wef, a scientific buddy. You will own nothing and you will be happy. We'll use genetic engineering. We will alter your identity.
Yeah.
Who you are.
Well, and don't
scary
forget
statements.
when you talk about who's controlling what and who's controlling the dialogue, let's go back to that InQtel and Facebook, because if you remember, folks, one of the first things that was like huge that happened with Facebook was in 2011, and that was the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. And that was literally started on a Facebook post.
Yeah.
Where somebody was like, hey, this is no, I'm done with this. And the Arab Spring began. And they were right there, January 2011. And, you know, that guy, that account was, that dude was never really found. You know, so yeah, like they literally used a social media platform to topple a government.
No, it's a long history of CIA interference of all governments.
You know, the one thing that I say regularly on this show is the concept of 80-20. Less than 20% of the standing populace of the United States fought in the American Revolution. The other 80% were like, you nutball, stop, enough. You're going to burn us all. So, it doesn't take convincing the greater percent of a population. It doesn't take, and even when you're talking about a means of control, it doesn't take a mass number of people.
No,
it does not take an overwhelming majority. This is not a court case.
Yeah, the Pentagon document said if 6 to 8% of people become aware the revolution is quite possible. So doesn't even need to be 20%. You know,
that's it. Yeah, and I mean, I just used the 20%, and I know the number was way less than 20. I want to say it was like 13 or something like that. I just used that as a generalization of humanity, period.
Right.
You know, out of every 100 people you talk to, probably about 20 people will get the deeper concept of a conversation. You know, the other 20... probably just waiting their turn to talk or waiting their turn to try to convince you of a paradigm. Not to have the conversation and the parry thrust block that exists in a active debate and open conversation, you know, an exchange of ideas. And yeah, to know that and to realize that, I almost posted the other day, hey, parents, try being honest with your kid. Let them know that, you know, whenever they're like, oh, I hate school, just be straight with them and go, you know, unfortunately, school is there to get you used to the tedium and monotony that exists 8 hours a day during the work week at a job that you may hate.
Yeah, that's the truth.
That is literally what school is there for. It is not there to educate until college level, high school level. It is not there for education.
Yeah.
Like, it is there literally to get you used to rote programming and to being able to just, like a bee, follow instructions for 8 hours.
Well, Chris, I need to head out here. I have a friend.
Absolutely.
Is that a Pac-Man machine behind you?
No. That is my home studio of synthesizers and video effects. I posted that the other day, and a buddy of mine was like, whoa, what arcade games are those?
Yeah.
I was like, they aren't arcade games, though they look like them. I was like, now I want arcade games, though. Well, I want to thank you for your time, as always, Doctor. It's always a great conversation. It's always enlightening to sit back and talk with you about these technologies. I always walk away with a new hope and a newfounded way to look at this situation and the technologies at hand. So thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I always enjoy our conversations.
Please do hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you are online checking out Dr. Duncan's work, you can go to Amazon, you can purchase How to Tame a Demon, you can also purchase his other book, Project Soul Catcher, which I've got right here. I have both of them, actually. But stop on by there, check that out. You could also go to the Curious Realm website. You can go there, you can hop by the store, and you can find Dr. Duncan's work there as well. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. As always, it is because of you great folks that we get to put out this content. So until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.